You guys ready to do this thing?
Do it.
I'm Matt Robinson.
I'm Noah Bissell.
And this is Graining In.
Jake Kill.
I'm in the mood to be slow and careful. My body's ready for a mountain climb. All of a sudden it will all become lovely. The flower that opens in the morning light.
That's where the intro music goes.
It's especially awkward with Zoom, you know, but what are you going to do?
There's not a dance you guys do.
We are back on Zoom. We are back in the remote world. And I think you guys should be excited because we are about to have a podcast where I may say less than I've ever said on here. Because today we are sitting down with Jeff Mello from Bootleg Biology. I see the stickers around the brewery. I'm quite familiar with what it is, but when I'm touring people around that brewery and they ask me a question about yeast, it's about as quiet as I get in terms of the world of brewing and all the different ingredients and all the things. I find that living single cell organism to be the big black box for me.
Yeah, not really quite a question for either of us.
I'm just soaking that in right now. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to start because I think it is either a black box for, like, if you're not working at a brewery or, you know, maybe on a few other scenarios like yourself, you know, making yeast for brewers. I just think it's a thing that people don't even think about, period, a lot, if you're enjoying beer. I mean, hell, it's only been known for like 150 years that it was even an integral part of beer. So I think a good place to kind of start would just sort of be give the overview of what you do at Bootleg.
Well, I'm the chief yeast wrangler at Bootleg Biology. That's a great thing of starting a business is you can pretend to be who you want to be, dress for the job that you want.
Like it.
But really, my goal at Bootleg every day is to hopefully change the beer world in some small way. And we do that through microbes, yeast and bacteria, the little engines that kind of power our fun beer drinking lives. You know, our goal is to find new cultures that brewers like, that make tasty beer, that make brewers' lives easier. Homebrew and commercial. And so if we're doing that, if we're doing a good job on that, then I'm pretty happy. And I think, you know, for the history of Bootleg, which we've been kind of started in my kitchen in 2013. So for a little bit of time, I think, you know, we've met that goal and I don't think we've done the coolest thing that we have done yet. And so I'm excited about anything revolving yeast bacteria related. That's where we're headed and we're trying to figure it out. And I think if you have any interest in yeast and microbes or beer or brewing, hopefully, you know, you have something that you can teach me because I do not know everything about microbes and, anyone who acts like they do, doesn't.
Unfortunately, I won't be able to help you with the first part, but, yeah, so basically you supply. Again, going back to shedding a little bit of light on it, like, I mean, there's hundreds of cultures a brewer, home brewer, professional could buy at any time now. And frankly, almost overwhelmingly so, despite the fact that there's a huge amount of homogeny or just redundancy, I guess, with probably 50% of those choices, probably even more than that, from suppliers to supplier. And you're kind of alluding to me, Bootleg sticks out within the kind of increasing, I don't want to say C, because I don't really know how much like commercial yeast suppliers there are, but it seems sometimes like there's more than logically there should be, considering how like you look at a catalog, very similar, Bootleg does something very differently, which I'd definitely like to get into. But first, I want to go back to your kitchen.
Yes.
Because a recurring theme on this is like, especially if it's kind of when we do interviews outside of like you're a brewer or whatever, And I'm not sure if I've ever meant this question more, but knowing that you don't have a microbiology background, like, how the hell did this all come to be where now your business card literally says Chief Wrangler?
Well, the short answer, there was no one to stop me. But the long answer is a lot of trial and error. And that's why I love the beer world. I love the beer industry. Craft beer, is my lifeblood, because it's full of innovators and experimenters and people who didn't necessarily have a formal background. I mean, you guys might have a better sense of this, but the number of craft brewers I've met that have a formal brewing education is a pretty small percentage. And that just goes to show that you can make some great beer without necessarily having a lot of training, but just by figuring it out. And I think that was my approach with Bootleg. And I was a home brewer. I had a lot of free time on my hands because I had quit my job. I was a little burnout. And so I'd read an article from Mike Tunsmeyer, the Mad Fermentationist, about trying to find wild yeast kind of in your backyard. And I had some really terrible, horrendous, I mean, absolutely disgusting, probably technically unsafe experiments of wild cultures. But I knew that there was something special in them. But basically, I just had unfermented beer wort in a mason jar in my backyard, and it started growing mold and all kinds of fun, colorful things. But I knew of the concept of isolating pure culture. So my thought was, okay, so it's some kind of mixed culture in there. If I can pull out the good ones, there's no point throwing this away and just giving up. And so went to the University of Google, and then found how to make auger plates and how to isolate yeast. And I sure as hell did not do a good job. But the end result was a wild yeast from my backyard, and I was living in Arlington, Virginia at the time. So that became Arlingtonesis, our first culture. And so from there, I was just like, oh, damn. Dude, I don't know anything. I'm not anyone. I've brewed, 10 batches of homebrew. This is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And so not knowing enough to be scared about that endeavor, that's kind of how I ended up here.
My grandfather growing up would always tell me, you got to know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And it kind of has become one of my ethos that I live by. And I'm on this big thing. I talk to a lot of people about YouTube University or using Google or using all this access to information now to figure things out. But that's really easy when you're talking about photography or how to do this or how to do that. When it comes to serious science and figuring this out without a background in microbiology or any traditional science field, you were really able to gather all of this from Googling stuff and using the internet?
Well, there was some of that, and I can't take all the credit. I'm not superhuman. I am not a genius. I'm just some dude with some time.
For sure.
But a lot of helpful people along the way, people with science backgrounds who were just curious about what I was doing, or there was a lot of really good blogs. I consider 2013 as just being this really special time in the craft beer world where something had changed, and there was just this boom of interest on the internet with blogs or social media. And I think a lot of people were communicating more than they ever had about really obscure subjects, like even just making mixed culture beer. That was something that was still kind of on the frontier in 2013 in America, at least.
Yeah.
And so there was people who were trying to share information, and things like Milk the Funk didn't exist at that point. And so it was just a bunch of random people sharing information. And so if you were just a guy with a good idea, a guy or a gal who wants to just change beer or be involved in beer, and maybe you didn't really have any great ambitions, but you just wanted to do something unique, there was a ready audience of people who were interested and wanted to encourage you and wanted to share your posts. And I think I was just lucky to be starting up around that time. I was lucky to be in DC where I had Mike Tunsmeyer, who was just an awesome resource because he, had figured out so many ways of making sour beer at home and really just excellent beer. Jesper Åkerboom, who he's actually started his own yeast lab in DC too. He was a scientist with just a focus in beer making, and he was a helpful resource. I moved to Nashville not long after, and Brandon Jones, Embrace the Funk, now part of Yazoo, He was a great resource, friendly and encouraging. So I wish I could say I figured it all out on my own, but I think a lot of sharing of ideas and encouragement was really what got me doing what I was doing.
And real quick before you guys go to Technical Town, on that same wave, I found this the other day and found it incredibly interesting. Based on what you said, I do think craft beer in that time you talk about has been almost like an over-index beneficiary of social media. For some reason, it just plays so well there. And I was listening to Kevin Systrom, who founded Instagram, talk. Mm-hmm. And the original idea that ended up being Instagram was kind of what it is, but more like a check-in app. And it was like, I can go to a bar and tell my friends that I'm there and or people I don't know and meet up with them. But literally the first picture ever taken and posted on Instagram was a picture of a beer.
Oh, serious?
That was kind of what the essence of this was. Because in my mind, I always think, like, how do these people have 100,000 likes on just like a picture of a beer or a picture
Nothing
of a game?
Nothing has changed.
But it translates incredibly well, and it's literally rooted in the DNA of it being founded.
I think Instagram was really, for at least bootleg biology, one of the biggest sources of building an audience, is because I took a picture of a plate I streaked and posted it on Instagram because I was like, I don't know what to take a picture of. I'll do this weird little science thing that I'm doing. And a writer for Beer Advocate saw that and was like, dude, I want to write an article about you. And I was like,
no,
I've
shit.
Streaked like 3 plates in my life, but the answer is yes.
I can promise Kevin Systrom didn't say anything about yeast plates when he was talking about the early Instagram pictures.
Well, that makes total sense to me, though, because, again, most people haven't thought of that, much less seen a streaked, agar plate. And it's really cool. Like, it just looks alien almost. Yeah. I do want to quickly ask, though, what were you doing beforehand? Because there's a few things for me to unpack about just my personal, like, intimidation of just science in general, kind of like Matt said. So where were you coming from, and what did you get burnt out on?
So I had a political science background. So I'm originally from the Seattle area, and I moved to D.C. so I could change the world. Yeah, I heard that story.
Now you're just
before.
Changing a different type of world, a smaller world.
And so I was actually doing nonprofit fundraising, which was great. You know, I got to work with a lot of really great causes, and I do feel like I was changing the world. And so I already had that kind of mindset of, I want to not just clock in, clock out. I want to do something that I feel like has some kind of purpose. But I knew at some point I was like, okay, I'm not going to change the world, maybe the way that I originally thought in my early 20s. But I think I had the idea of, you know, just people power, people doing little things that have big effects. And I think that kind of coinciding with the boom in social media really was a great example of how that can truly happen. I don't think, I don't think a little yeast lab that specializes in unique cultures really has that chance of success in a pre-social media world. I just don't know if it does.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, it certainly would coincide, like we kind of said. I mean, it would coincide with a lot of things, but just with the proliferation in general of yeast labs. It's certainly, I mean, we actually opened in 2013. So that's very much kind of just a big blip on my timeline for how my perspective kind of changes. But to that science point, without having come from that background at all, I guess there's just enough art, I guess, in brewing maybe it's really just this duality. You know, I always hear about that, this duality of beer, which science on one end and art on the other. And I very much gravitated more towards the art side. And frankly, I mean, even to this day, to a large degree, the hard science still intimidates me a fair amount. And obviously, I'm not so much that I, you know, ignore it or don't try to learn about it all the time, hence this conversation. But the not having that background and then saying, okay, it sounds like a good idea to actually sell a product exclusively based in science, that I would have to imagine this level of scrutiny that would come with that, because it's like, it's either right or wrong. Yeah. You know, it's either pure or not. So talk a little bit about beyond just sort of the feedback, like how things really got started, how Bootleg scaled. I don't really know. I'm sure it's not barrelage, so I'm not really sure how you speak in sizing of a yeast lab. But yeah, all those kind of things.
So I think the thing for me was, okay, first off, if I can do this, anyone can do this. And so really breaking down that wall between brewing as just, you know, a pursuit of, you know, a food, but also as something in tandem with science that helps you get your goals. And I think we all do this every day with cooking, right? You have to have a basic understanding of chemistry to be a cook, right? I mean, without even thinking about it. And I think obviously that applies to brewing very much so.
Yep.
And so I think the same thing applies to micro. And I think really it's a failure in our education as a country that we've made science seem so prohibitively difficult, expensive, all those things.
Yeah.
And so my first goal truly was, okay, let me show you how you can isolate a pure culture in your house. And for the most part, it's totally doable. Is it the easiest thing to do? No. Do you want to start a yeast lab out of your house? Probably not. But can you find wild cultures, purify them, and grow them? Definitely. And so that was kind of my goal with Bootleg, is to put the information on how to do that. So we have had a DIY yeast section on there since the beginning. I'm just teaching those basic science skills, which really, when it comes down to it, not to undersell what Bootleg Biology does or any other yeast lab, but the core aspect of yeast propagation is kind of like entry-level micro. There's those things you learn in your first micro class if you're going to do anything in the medical field. So if you really are diehard about yeast cultures, I would really suggest just take an intro micro course, and you will learn so much, probably more science than you'll ever need. But the core concepts are really translatable to anything you would do in the brewing world. And that's kind of how I started off. And so I took a micro class, and I had a PhD who was my professor. And after class, you know, I would come up to him, I'm like, okay, let's talk about Brettanomyces. And he's like, I have never heard of this yeast culture before, because they usually just talk about micro in the context of pathology. You know, like, what's going to kill humans is really what the focus of microbiology
pretty
usually
important,
is.
Pretty important stuff.
But I'm like, I want to make better beer. So that's kind of how that was. And I think it helped that our focus was on wild cultures. So we started something called the Local Yeast Project, where I was trying to get other people to send me their cultures so I could store them and build out this big bank of wild yeast cultures. And so that the fact that our focus was on wild yeast, I don't think we had as much scrutiny as if I started up and I was like, I want to be White Labs 2.0. That was never my goal. Yeah. I was like, White Labs is already doing that. You know, they were already very effective and had a lot of history. And I was brewing with White Labs and white yeast cultures as a home brewer. Like, that wasn't who I was wanting to emulate. I wanted to do something that was really exciting to me, which was wild cultures. And be something that, you know, really changed beer, because I didn't have the history there that made me want to emulate people as much as try to do something different. And so trying to focus on wild yeast cultures and bacteria was really kind of our beginning. And I think at that time period, you know, 2013, 2015, there's just an explosion of breweries opening up sour programs, making Brett beers. People worshiping at the temple of Lambic. I think that was just a great time to be starting up, because it was just that so much excitement. And so that's what we were trying to do, you know. But as time goes on, you know, I realized, as a person trying to pay bills and, you know, try to have employees and like have a little bit of work-life balance, was that, oh, we need to be kind of a big boy yeast lab and try to expand what our bank is and what's available to people. And very quickly I realized, it's like, oh, people want to make IPAs. We should probably have IPA yeast too, you know? Yeah. So that kind of thing is, I'm just as excited about, because I drink IPAs all the time. But having a little bit of everything, but having it always be unique and different, has always been the goal. And we probably could have been a lot bigger sooner if we decided to be one of those like kind of copy and paste yeast labs where we're just like, here's our version of this culture. And it's basically the same thing, but it's just buy it from us. You know, that wasn't really what I wanted to do.
Yeah. And I guess just a quick, tangent on that. You'd be a great person to ask because you hear varying things, and I've even kind of seen varying results when I've gotten, let's say, you know, different strains of Chico, from places. Like, how much variance is I guess almost allowed in that from supplier to supplier? Because on paper, it's technically the same, a culture from the same source that's isolated. What should people expect if like, normally I get my, is your English strain, is that like a London 3?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, the variation of that,
So I guess like how different is the classic English from Bootleg versus like what I'd get at BSI, say?
I mean, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, I think as a home brewer, we were, you know, religiously looking at Mr. Malty, just like, okay, what's the comparison chart between this white lab strain, this white yeast strain? And even if say they came from the same brewery and theoretically it was the same strain, if they got it from a different generation, then they are propagating a slightly different culture. So I would say all these yeast labs very likely have a slightly different version. And so you will get something. Is it going to be as different as popping in a German ale strain? No, but, you might get little differences in attenuation. You know, you might get little differences in just the flavor and aroma profile you get. You know, I've had brewers just straight up do that. Just like, look, here's your version versus this version. And I don't like your version. I like this one. And that's totally fair because I think on some level, once you hit the numbers, it's really about perception. And that stuff is so personal. You know, what you like in an IPA is so, it really is so personal that you can't always make everyone happy. And that's totally reasonable because we're all unique individuals with our different experiences. And so that is totally true. But that being said, I think there's room in the beer yeast world and the use of bacteria to find cultures that can make those styles of beer, but are different, beyond just being, oh, here's a slightly different version of this culture. And so like we have our NEPA blend. So that was first time we really wanted to come out with a clean culture that you could make IPAs with. But it was unlike anything else. And so really what we wanted to do was just like, let's take the best of multiple worlds and combine them and come up with a blend. And I think most people were just making, you know, thinking of beers with blends as being mixed culture. But I think you can just do amazing things, with clean beers if you use multiple strains. And it's not hard, and you can a lot of times get multiple generations without it getting crazy. And so you can use different yeast cultures that are in that same realm, that flavor profile, English or whatever, but they have different results. And then you come up with a new unique final product that's just unlike anything as a pure culture. And I just love coming up with blends in that way.
Mm. And talking about blends a little bit on your interview with Milk the Funk, or at least the one I listened to, you guys talked about like how pre-Bootleg there used to be yeast trading groups on Facebook.
Yes,
and that blew my mind.
Yes.
So it speaks, I think, to like just as the way there's beer trading groups, there's people trading cultures. And I think it just speaks to kind of the wild westness of that side of the industry, especially with at the mixed culture stuff. What were like, you must have had some epiphany about what Wild Collection to sort of a, like have the local yeast projects to this day still be like a very big part of what Bootleg does. What was it? Arlington?
Yeah. Arlington.
Arlington. Yeah, I knew there was one extra vowel there.
Missed a syllable.
Was sort of like your results with that? Because as you say, you know, I've done it maybe it's only since we've been operating professionally, but a couple seasons, you know, we'll throw like 20 jars of wort out in various places that kind of have meaning or whatever. And, you know, you'll get different results, but then that's only the beginning because then you're weeding out there. Yep. Then it's growing up. Like, it's a lot of fucking work. And a lot of mystery to a certain degree. So I guess I'm still just kind of interested in what got you through that hump enough to not only push through that, but then the humanitarian side in you wants to spread this truth that it's actually a lot easier than everyone else tells you.
Well, I didn't have a job, Noah.
Too much time on my hands.
I mean, I just truly think I wanted to find what I could add to the beer world. And here's the other thing is I didn't have a background where I was trying to come into the beer industry and tell everyone like it is. I was coming as like, hey, let's learn together. Here's what I'm learning. And then let's share this. I think one of the early lessons was that for the most part, wild cultures that ferment beer are Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So, you know, there are a lot of species of yeast out there in the world, and there's a decent amount that can ferment beer. But the vast majority that you're going to find in the wild that will attenuate your beer to the point that we would want to drink it is a cerevisiae strain. So that was an eye-opener is that, we're giving it beer to ferment. Of course, we're going to pull out, you know, beer-centric yeast strains, but they are going to be wild in nature. And then the other thing was that a lot of them are very much in the kind of Saison Belgian-esque profile. You know, I was hoping for a lot more variety in the flavor profiles, but as a pure culture, you know, a lot of them can make a really nice passable Saison. And I think that's a lovely thing. But it also means that if you're trying to make a beer that's not phenolic, you kind of have limited options if you're trying to use wild cultures exclusively. So, you know, I didn't know that going into it and I just had a lot of hope, but I think the fact that, you know, people are still brewing beer with wild cultures and using pure wild cultures. I just got back from Asheville and went to Cellaris, and Mark just opened up last year during the pandemic, and he had a couple beers that were primary fermented with a pure wild culture that he found not far from the brewery. And so he sent that to us and we banked it. And so he can order that wild culture from us and he uses that for some of his beers, but some of the other beers are, you know, totally domestic cultures and aren't anything close to wild. But I think the way he thinks about the process of using that culture, he's always coming up with a unique style of beer. And it's not just, oh, here's my latest Saison with this wild culture. It's really just a precursor for some other way he's going to play with that beer, whether he's putting it in oak or he's adding bacteria or some kind of other fun adjunct or something. It's a way to create a house flavor profile on some of those beers in a unique way.
Totally.
As somebody who is admittedly ignorant to this, when it comes to the local yeast project, I'm curious if you had to incentivize people to send that to you in any way, or if there was enough interest in coming in and people were excited to do that, and to break down a little bit of what they get out of it in its entirety. If it's beyond just banking and having access to this in the future, and then on your side, outside of just kind of growing your catalog and the number of things you have, just talk about that a little bit further.
Yeah, I mean,
as if I'm a small child.
Well, you know, I think being a part of the culture of homebrewing, we just have a lot of people who are just excited about what we're doing and just wanted to send their cultures. Because some of them just like, hey, I've had this thing in my fridge and I've been keeping it going for years. Do you want to have it? You know, and I think it's just for them, it wasn't some kind of like monetary thing. It was just like, shit, I'll share it. I got trillions of cells, you know, I'm not going to lose it.
Totally.
Lose any sleep over
I got cells to spare.
So it was kind of that. And then also we started making the Backyard Yeast Wrangling Toolkit, which was kind of everything you needed to recreate out of the isolate your own yeast strain. And so it has a built-in way for people to send in a sample. But I think a lot of it is just getting the recognition, like on our website, just like, hey, you captured this culture, you found this culture. And then just the free, we basically offer free banking of those cultures. And so whether you're a home brewer or even a professional brewer that's working with wild cultures, if it's for the local yeast project, we'll bank that culture for free. And so you'll know it's always available to you. And maybe it's just, hey, I have an anniversary beer. I always make this every year. You know, it's really special to me, this culture.
Yep.
And so that's cool. Or it could be there's people who gave us their culture 5 years ago. And then they're like, I'm starting up my brewery. I need my yeast now. And so it's cool to be part of that cycle of going from homebrew to pro. And they know that their yeast has been in good hands and they can use it now to make those beers on a larger scale. I think that being part of that side of the community, I think has been really cool for me. But
that's incredible.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how this will translate to audio, but I think with you at the helm, probably pretty decently. I'm genuinely curious about having someone again, maybe like with some small child tonalities, explain really that process of isolation. Because you know, I've read a little bit about it. It just intimidates me again, and it seems intrinsically difficult. So what are those sort of stages of that? And then after that, once you do get that, what does banking look like on a professional scale?
Well, this could get super dry, so I'm going to do this in the style of Patrick Stewart, if that's okay. Does that work?
No. Okay.
No.
All right.
No, just kidding. No, but
just allow me to Google who Patrick Stewart is real quick,
Captain
and
Kirk.
I'll be tuned right back. Oh,
God. Yeah.
No, so here's the thing is, you know, yeast is microscopic, but all of us know what yeast looks like, right? You get enough yeast cells and it looks like something, right? It's that thick mess, you know, it's, you can physically pick it up in your hands, but when it's microscopic, a few cells, you can't. And so really the goal of isolation is to grow very small amounts on an auger plate that you can see, but not enough that you know, it's like a yeast slurry. And an auger plate is really, it's kind of, it looks just like Jell-O, you know, it uses auger, and auger is something that's used in food. It just sets really well. If you boil something with auger, it'll turn into kind of like this gelatinous substance. So it's really fun for making food, but also, you can mix it with things like, malt extract and make a perfect growth media for yeast, because yeast needs malt to grow. And then the auger just helps it set. And so really you're just putting just a small amount of liquid on auger, just the tiniest amount. And then you want just a couple cells to grow up, and then they make what they call colonies, which are basically just like, they look like tiny little buttons. And from there, you can start up your culture, because you know that it started as one cell and you can look at it and it's grown in one spot. It doesn't move around, doesn't roll around. You know, from that one spot, that's that one culture. So you could have started with 10, but you can visually pick out one, and then from there you can grab that one little button colony and propagate it. So you could, at Bootleg, everything starts off a plate, and then we'll go from a plate to 10 or 40 mils of sterilized malt extract. And then you just make a starter from there. So it's really simple. Like I say, I could do it, you could do it. Maybe it's hard, a little bit hard to explain, but the core concepts are pretty similar to brewing. And then banking is, it just really depends on what you want to do on it. For a lab, you know, you usually have specialized equipment, but I've seen some really badass homebrew labs where I'm just like, damn, dude, you have as many cultures as I do, and this is your house. But you can do essentially what we call like a slant, which is using that auger media instead of doing it on a round plate where you're streaking something out. Essentially it's, you pour it into a container at an angle. And so it's really easy to cap on a container. And then once you streak that, it grows for a few days, and you can stick that in a fridge, and you can constantly culture from a slant for months. Because really the only problem is that the yeast will grow on that auger media for as long as it can. And then eventually it'll dry out and it'll get too dry for the yeast to survive. But if you put it in a container with a cap, it doesn't really dry out. And so it can last for a long time. And so you can, that was the very earliest banking for bootleg, was just a slant with agar in it in my fridge for months and then just constantly having to reculture it. But there are more higher end things you can do to store cultures, which we do now, as we have a negative 80 Celsius freezer. So it's basically the same thing as a regular freezer, but it just has another compressor on it that pushes it even lower. And they're exceedingly expensive, but the process is really simple. You know, we add, we'll take slurry sample and then we'll add glycerin, which is just a food derived product. And it helps prevent ice crystals from forming. So in the deep freezing process, the yeast cells aren't dying from the ice crystals. And essentially, it's basically good forever. If you store that yeast high viability, you stick them in the freezer. And, you know, we have cultures that we banked many years ago that are still doing quite well. And really, the only time you kind of lose viability is kind of every time you pull them out of the freezer and try to culture them. You know, it drops viability a little bit. But that's it. You know, I mean, there's really, really expensive, fancy ways you can do it, too. But this is the simple way. And a little bit of time and Googling, you know, I figured it out.
in a very real way. I mean, on one hand, it's like, well, I guess I don't have to figure it out because I have you. But on the other hand, I very much believe you when you say that. And you know, looking at the website, and it's really admirable, honestly, to still maintain like not. I'm sure indirectly, maybe it can help the business, but really, there's just kind of a greater good mentality behind that isn't directly tied to really anything from the bottom line anyway.
Yeah, the local yeast project is not paying our bills.
I didn't see any way it possibly could be looking at it.
Fun Nipa Blend or Oslo, you know, and that's great because here's your feel-good moment for the day. You are, in a way, benefiting those home brewers storing their local yeast project cultures with us. Because we can, you know, we can spend a little bit of that time doing those kind of things on the side because we're supported by homebrewers and professional brewers doing other fun projects. So,
Where does sales kind of break down? I get the impression that it was very homebrewer centric early on in the early days, but now, I mean, it's as easy to order commercial pitches as it is anywhere. You know, BSI is where we get most of our, you know, our house kind of Portland strain and our lager strain. But, you know, they're just big and been around for a while. So it makes sense that their online ordering would be pretty smooth, but yours is just as smooth. So I'd imagine I'm curious where that breakdown is now.
Well, yeah, the majority of our sales are commercial orders. You know, the hard thing with homebrew, and it's like, I love it. I want to support the homebrew community. It's where we come from. We're known for. We produce a ton of homebrew cultures, but at a practical level, it is very time consuming to propagate a bunch of yeast and then individually package it and then individually, you know, sticker it and then wrap it and ship it and then, you know, handle logistics of shipping. You know, it's like, it's so time consuming. That we truly can't do it all the time. So the commercial side is really what the core of our business is. And really, I mean, to be honest, I really haven't pushed the commercial side because, you know, we are a small yeast lab. And if I was at CBC trying to grab everyone, with a beard who walked by, I would be struggling to take care of our core customer base. And so I've really just tried to make it, you know, the online side as easy as possible, but really word of mouth and then just trying to stick with the people who've supported us and then just slowly grow. You know, and we're at a point where we need to grow and we're trying to come up with plans on how we can expand our production capabilities, because if you're not growing, you know, you're not succeeding. So that's something that we always need to do. But I never wanted to be at a point where we had to pay the bills so bad that we weren't able to focus on the things that we wanted to do. And I think by building up an organic demand and interest, we've been able to little by little grow it so that we were never at that point. And I truly hope that Bootleg in 5 years is really still trying to push the envelope of cultures and still stick into that kind of realm as much as possible. So that's my goal.
Mm.
It sounds like a really good balance.
Yeah. And on just sort of where you are pushing things, and I would, for my personal experience, what defines the company the most is the Sour Solera series. I think either two, if not three, fooders across the street are
nice.
Were started with one of those cultures. And we'll send you some beers that have at least in part been blended with those after this.
I'm ready. Any moment, please. But
if we had any modicum of foresight, we would have been before, but
beforehand.
That's not how we go. I was curious, like, because when I hear Solera, you know, naturally you think of a whether it's a carboy, fooder, whatever, that just kind of keeping this going, even though that's technically not the where the term originates from with sherry and stuff.
Sure.
But I think in brewing, that's how everyone thinks about it. It dawned on me that, like, you probably do not have a fooder at the yeast lab. And there's a good chance you don't even have a carboy. So is that for each, because that blend changes, what, twice a year? Do you put that out?
Three times. Yeah. So
three times.
You know, so it started off truly as we were propagating that in a barrel. So we're... Mm. You know, we're in Nashville, Tennessee.
Small fooder, bro.
Yeah.
Small fooder.
We were in Tennessee, and Corsair Distillery is in town, and they have a ton. They use a lot of, like, 5 gallon whiskey barrels. And so they are constantly getting rid of those. And so if you're a home brewer in Nashville, you are just loaded with whiskey barrels. And so we had a lot of access to those barrels. And so we started off, it was like, let's treat this as, like you were saying, no more of like how a craft brewer thinks of a Solera. Let's start with a base culture and then keep it going and then just feed it. And then we'll propagate off of that culture. Just because the thought was that those are the ones that are doing well, that they're not just, hey, in a lab, and then we piece this to this, and then we'll throw it together, and then there's your blend. Let's just really get as hardcore as possible in how we treat these mixed cultures. At some point, it just became impractical to prop off these 5 gallon wood barrels. But what it was is just the source of these mixed cultures, and so now we'll propagate. Essentially in a flask, so it's just a little bit easier and cleaner and simpler to maintain. And then the newest, greatest cultures that we come across, because we're constantly coming across really unique cultures, goes into that Solera. So any newest variation of Sour Solera blend has the newest cultures that we've come across. So it's always a little bit different. But we've done it enough times that we recently did a brew where we brewed a batch of beer with every single release that we'd ever done. And I can't remember what we were at this point, but we tasted through them all and we picked our favorites. And so we re-released those. And so those are on our website. And it was interesting to see that change in flavor profile, because the ones that were early on in that 2015 year were just aggressively sour. And that was when we were still in the barrel. And it's clear to me that the bacteria, the PDO, was so entrenched in that barrel that it dominated that blend. And so it was really just a PDO Brett bomb, because they were the primary cultures. But as time goes on, when we move out of that barrel situation, and we started adding a little more diversity of cultures to get it a little bit further away from a Brett and PDO bomb, we started seeing some more delicate flavors develop. And I think that's something to think about when you're running your own Solera at home, is that it's a really cool way of maintaining a mixed culture and creating a house culture. But with enough time, some of those cultures end up trying to dominate your flavors. And so you might end up with a very aggressively sour beer or just a lot of funk that kind of becomes unbalanced. So if you're going to do that, it's really ideal to have maybe multiple barrels that you can use for blending or refreshing that stock. Or next time you put some wort on top of it, really bump up the IBU so that the bacteria are a little under control. So there's ways that you can control that. But with our Solera blends, ideally, you know, going forward, you're going to get more uniqueness in cultures versus just aggressively one direction.
Totally. Yeah, I can't tell. I can't even count the amount of brewers I've talked to that, especially when we were getting things going here. And oddly, early, usually like actually getting getting like noticeable acidity can actually be kind of hard if you're not kettle souring. But then something happens pretty quickly where the script completely flips and you're fighting against acidity taking over. And I was warned and it was like, oh, I guess that's not going to happen for me because I can't get any. And then, but no, it's true. So very, very factual. And also to that, when you were just kind of going to where these cultures live, it made me think about something you were talking about in the Sour Hour episode that honestly I didn't really know much about. First was the fact that, like, I think there's a misconception with people when you think about wild capturing. I think there's the assumption that it's going to be Brett for most people. Like, yeah. Brett has this idea, is this wild, you know, wild thing out there. And so, like, of course it's going to be Brett. So first I heard you say that's, frankly, quite rare. And then beyond that, well, I'll let you answer that one first and then piggyback into the next part.
I mean, yeah, no, it totally is. And like, I was kind of hanging out with the local yeast project is usually – because we're trying to find things to do well in beer, usually we're trying to find, or we're going to find Cerevisiae cultures. So good old brewer's yeast, but variations that are more in the Belgian, you know, phenolic flavor profile. Mm-hmm. And so that's the norm. I'm not saying that you can't find those things, but I would say that it's really maybe just a misconception of how Belgian lambic is made. And I think people assume that, you know, you can only get these Brett strains and Brussels. And I think the Belgian brewer, you know, they're making a product. And so they actually need some consistency. And so they, I think they have some tricks that they use to, you know, they're still doing spontaneous, they're still doing wild cultures, but a way to keep consistency and to make sure that the Brett is always there, the bacteria is always there, but kind of just under control. And so I think that kind of misconception help people think that there's just Brett out everywhere. But that being said, I mean, there's still fun species out there. You know, people discovered that there are lactic acid producing yeast just by trying to find wild cultures. And so they're out there. You can get, you know, sour yeast from the wild. We have quite a few in our bank. I don't always like the flavor profile they make, but it's totally doable. So there are cultures out there that are unique. You know, our Sour Weapon P culture, it has Pedio pentasaceus, which is a really unique species of Pediococcus. It's not like Damnosus like you would find in our Sour Cellar or, you know, any kind of like lambic type beer. It is kind of just an aggressive lactic acid producer, but I think the flavor profile is very different from Lactobacillus. And so thinking about bacteria in a different way is something that I like to talk about, because I think people just assume that, oh, it just makes lactic acid. It's just, that's just what it is. But it really isn't. You know, there's a lot of, maybe not as much variety as there is with yeast flavors, but there's a lot of things to be discovered just with bacteria and how you work with cultures to produce a nice acid profile on a beer, even if it is a quick sour, kettle sour kind of thing.
Yeah. And on that same note, you were kind of already going there. In that Sour Hour podcast, you were talking about how with lambic fermentations, there's actually the presence of a lot of just species that the layman doesn't even hear of. Like, it's not in brewing books. Why are those more a part of that potpourri in that fermentation than I mean, obviously you're not pitching yeast, so that gives it, so that's part of the equation. But what exactly is that mechanism that attracts so many different things?
Well, I think it's just like, I truly don't think people realize how much we are just surrounded by microbes all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, people are paranoid of getting sick all the time, but what they don't think about too is that you're surrounded by microbes that just live on your skin. They live in your mouth. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you've ever touched a human being, you've kind of exchanged microbes. And that's cutting out some other fun things you can do with other human beings. You know, so
high five.
Totally. Handshakes. Yeah.
But I'm saying they're everywhere. And then if you've been to Cantillon, it is not in the countryside. You know, it's in the heart of Brussels. And that's why
kind of a gross part of Brussels.
Yeah, I mean, I went there on vacation and it was so eye opening. I'm like, they're making this beer and really just a very much as a city, and they're letting the air, and you know, they're, what is it, on the second, third floor of their building? And what's at that same height is the people venting off their bathrooms in the rooms.
Right.
It's about the same
any
height.
Any smokes, any stack of any sorts coming up there.
I'm not saying it's dirty. I'm just saying that, like, there's a, you're right, you're a potpourri of microbes out there, and they're going to get in where they can. But the great thing about beer making is, you know, beer naturally has a lower pH, which makes it harder for pathogenic microbes to survive. So that's a really big plus. You introduce hops, it's going to inhibit certain types of bacteria. So the natural way of making beer that we are familiar with really kind of prevents those microbes from taking hold. And once you intentionally add trillions of cells, I mean, it's basically game over for anything that isn't happy in beer. You know, that's what, you know, when people realize that diastaticus yeast was such a problem, it was primarily because, you know, it could be just as happy in beer as any English yeast strain, but it hung out just a little bit too long to over-attenuate your beer. But it's pretty rare to find a microbe that wants to do that, that isn't some kind of beer microbe. And so I think it's a nice, happy accident. Otherwise, I don't know if human civilization would exist if that weren't the case.
Yeah, you really, like, as much as you kind of hear when you look into wild yeast and everything about, like, how things could be bad, I've never heard of anyone getting sick off beer from just a microbiology reason. But I also am not trying to, you know, put that broad stroke disclaimer to a man that kind of needs people to feel safe.
You're like,
in the
no
product,
one told me it was safe, so I just did it.
And as we get into wrapping up, I had saved this little spot at the end where I thought I'd have like hundreds of layman's questions to kind of root some of this in the more basic. But really, I think that all of that was incredibly well explained. It all made sense to me. I just had one little question when you were talking about isolating yeast. When you were talking about that part in the middle, you said that they can live in the fridge for quite some time, and especially when you have them capped like that. But eventually you will have to reculture it. What do you mean when you say reculture it?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, essentially, you could streak it onto another auger plate or onto another slant, or just brew a batch of beer with it, you know. Essentially, as long as you're feeding the yeast, you know, like, people are familiar with sourdough mothers. It's like, it's constantly about feeding it and keeping it fed, and that's any life form. So make sure it has something to eat. If you want to keep it a pure culture, it's easier to do that on some kind of auger media like a plate or a slant. But you can certainly culture it with beer. And I know a lot of people who just repitch the same starter over and over again. You know, the benefit of having this kind of knowledge and experience with isolating yeast is you can actually check the purity of your cultures. I mean, that's something that I think a lot of brewers take for, I think we started off talking about, it's like, oh, you just something you just add sometimes.
Yeah.
And really, you know, there's a lot of thought that obviously goes into it before you get that yeast in your hands. But I really try to encourage brewers of all sizes to think about the yeast as not being done once you receive it. You need to make sure that if you can, that it's a pure culture, even when you receive it from a lab, because labs aren't perfect. You know, those kind of things. Yeah. And then
pretty notable, pretty notable instance of that.
One's
we won't name any
yours,
names,
one's in Wuhan. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, we're perfect, but you know, no, but, you exactly. know, like, it's humans, anything involving humans, you know, they're not always perfect.
Exactly.
And then also too, a great way to save money is by reculturing, you know, by harvesting your yeast, repitching your yeast. But I think a lot of people get in this mindset that, well, I got it pure and I have good SOPs, it'll always stay pure. And that's not necessarily the case. Anytime you touch that yeast, you're moving it, you're racking it. You let in the smallest amount of environmental air, there's a chance it can get contaminated. And so sometimes people are like, hey, my yeast is acting a little bit weird. If they have the ability to say, just streak it out on a plate, you might be able to go, oh, well, that's because there's something else in there. And that's something that actually isn't that hard to find out. And I think, if people took the time, man, your brewing would just go for the, really just improve just having that knowledge of how your yeast is and not necessarily always blaming a yeast lab or blaming something else. Sometimes it's, oh, there's a problem with your equipment that you didn't catch, and it'd be way better to catch that earlier than downline once you're having a really sad batch of beer. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Awesome.
On that same token, I just have one last quick thing to ask before we do our little wrap up game. Still be out of here by 11:15, I promise.
Cool.
Going to sort of that identification when you do streak, I heard you, I think, talking with Dan on Milk the Funk about the visual, what you called morphologies, which is what I assumed is sort of when that little archipelago of yeast starts forming within the plate, that there are just identifiers that you can use at least to kind of broad strokes identify at least genus, maybe even more specifically than that, based on sort of the shade of color they are, the look. Is that right, or am I reading too much into that?
No, that's totally right, you know, and I think a lot of people assume that there's, you know, you have to do some kind of genetic sequencing all the time to differentiate things, but that's expensive and time consuming, and really I consider using auger plates the gold standard, and really the difference between bootleg now and bootleg in my house is just what auger media in some ways we're using, because we use very specialized auger media that is meant to either help us visually inspect what that culture is or what else is in that culture, or to prevent other microbes from growing. And so we know that it can only be this. So we use three different media. We use WLN, and that's the one where visually it pretty much can grow any kind of yeast. And so it's just your knowledge of what that looks like. So it could be the shape, how big it gets, how fast it grows, the color, you know, like Chico looks very different from a Saison strain. And just by doing it enough times, just being that familiar with it, I can pick it out of a lineup. You know, all of our core strains we visually can inspect. But then we have FPDM, which is a new media that Matt Farber came up with, which has just been great because it helps detect diastaticus yeast. So really a very, very narrow growth media that only certain things can grow on, meaning yeast that can ferment beer too much, essentially. So if you get a hit on that, you're like, oh, I have a problem. Whereas say your beer was at a normal finishing gravity, like 10.08, you know, and you get a ton of hits for a diastaticus yeast, you're like, it's not going to stay there for long. So you at least have some kind of heads up.
Yeah.
And then we use MRS, which is specifically for growing bacteria. And we add a substance in there that prevents yeast from growing. So if something grows on MRS, then we know for the most part it's bacteria. Not always, but for the most part it is bacteria. And that helps for quality control stuff. It helps for isolation. So if like a brewer sends us their mixed culture and they're like, hey, I just want the bacteria out of this. This is like a stellar souring bacteria. It's really straightforward process from our perspective on how to find that bacteria and isolate it and blend it.
Awesome. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
I could keep you here for a lot longer than this, so we'll do you the courtesy, but
absolutely.
We do like to wrap up one little quick way.
We wrap all these with what we call the three bay. Start off graining in, you end at the three bay, and I always say that it's a fun kind of free association thing at the end, but this time it's truly perfect because, as Noah touched on at the beginning, the art versus science aspect, we just spent 55 minutes on the science incredibly well. Now we get to the art part, the creativity part. We're going to give you three things and a category for three other things.
Yeah.
And then you're going to put them together and tell us why. I'll let Noah take it away.
So kind of going back to your former career, and I think some of the ethos you still maintain, I'm going to give you three famous humanitarians. We got Mother Teresa.
Big
one. Gandhi, another big one.
Very big one.
And we'll go Martin Luther King Jr., another very big one.
Domestic, huge one.
And then let's just go with right in your wheelhouse, associate each of them with either sack, brat, or bacteria.
Oh, man. So not only is this difficult, I'm probably going to piss off 1,000 people at the same time.
I could get you canceled.
All six of them. Canceled. I don't think you can yet. Yeah. This podcast isn't nearly big enough for that, so I wouldn't worry.
Oh, man. Okay. Man.
You can go strain specifics if you want to. If you want to just do all sack strains, doesn't matter to me.
Okay. I will say that, oh man, I'll say Mother Teresa is a Kolsch strain. I'm not entirely sure why. I just envision a nice, peaceful, calm, chill Kolsch beer that I associate with Mother Teresa. So I'm going to go with that.
She's not known for being wild.
No, she's not a wild lady from my perspective.
That works. That works.
Okay. Gandhi, I'm going to go with Chico. I'm going to say that probably a strain later discovered to be kind of just the core of what makes beer good, but probably through, you know, the past 100 years of brewing, no one really knew it existed or cared, but came late to the party and maybe changed the history of beer. So I'll say Chico for
that's a great answer.
Yeah, that is a great answer.
And then I'll say Martin Luther King. I will say is Norwegian Quaik, because really changed the world in ways that maybe we weren't ready for. I think when Quaik came around, people weren't ready to make an IPA in 2 days. And I think there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of disbelief. I think it still exists. And I'm not saying that everyone is making IPAs with Norwegian Quaik, but I think it really made people change and reassess how they brew. And I think MLK, you know, did that a lot for a lot of people in our country, is to reassess what your values are and what you think is important, and maybe try to change the world in a unique way. And that's the best I can come up with.
That's an incredible
that
closer,
was fantastic.
Baby.
No, that was very great. Very great. Very self-doubting closer. Man. That was absolutely fantastic.
You definitely owe me some beer for those questions, guys.
No problem.
They're coming.
But I know you got a busy day ahead of you. Jeff Mello, Bootleg Biology, thank you so much for joining us, man. If you are either a home brewer or a professional brewer listening to this and have not bought from Bootleg, I would truly highly recommend it. It's very much you have separated yourself from the noise in a very real way.
Absolutely.
And a lot of respect from me on that front.
Cool. Thank you so much, fellas. This was awesome. Thank you for having me on.
That was an hour well spent.
Yeah.
I'm in the mood.